That's one that he gave us this morning, I think. He just now got it.
He comes to our Fish and Wildlife Commission meetings pretty often for help with bears, bear damage.
Does he give a lot of damage?
Board members all look refreshed and ready for the balance of our business of the day. As noted before break, we're joined by Deputy Supervisor Mary Byrne for Resource Protection Services, and by First Assistant Division Manager John Kaikman to provide us an overview of 2014 wildfire season and our forest health-related landowner assistance work. And thank you very much, Mary and John, for joining us. Please take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. We appreciate the opportunity to brief you on the 2014 fire season and probably at least as much importance and of interest to you is the landowner assistance that DNR provides after fires. And we will also touch on fire prevention and our work with landowners to prevent the devastating effects of wildfires. We'll go fairly quickly through this presentation, so please stop me if you have questions along the way. And if there's follow-up, I brought a notepad so that if there's additional information, you might have to be sure to get back to the board members. Okay, John? Go ahead. As you are all well aware, this was a devastating wildfire season, but I wanted to just make sure that I provide you a brief overview of DNR's wildfire fighting mission. We are the state's largest on-call wildland firefighting service. We're really the largest fire department in the state of Washington. We provide protection on 13 million acres of state and private forest land across the state. We work with other fire agencies, especially local fire agencies, to make sure that we send the closest forces to respond to the fire from the moment it's reported. And then we have interagency agreements with federal agencies and other state agencies as well. We employ about 1,100 trained firefighting personnel, 700 of whom are regular DNR employees with other jobs, for example, foresters, who, when the fire bell rings, don their fire gear and implement their training to go out and help fight wildfires. And they're supplemented with about 400 seasonal employees. Priorities for wildland firefighting are always in this order: safety and protection of human life, minimizing damage to property, and protecting natural resources. So this season was a doozy. This slide depicts the conditions in Twisp, Washington on July 17th, but it is really emblematic of the entire season that we experienced. Generally this summer we had very high temperatures. We had very low humidities, and when the wind picked up, we were just prime for big fires to start. All they lacked was an ignition source. And the photo on the left is an indication of why, once the ignition source arrived, the conditions were ideal for the start and spread of catastrophic wildfires. The conditions, as you're well aware, in eastern Washington in particular, include forests that are in very poor shape, a lot of ladder fuels, crowns that are already dead or dying, and this created just a tinderbox situation. And then when the ignition came, it came with a vengeance. We had lightning storm after lightning storm, and once lightning strikes under those circumstances, it's off and running. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the responsibility that our firefighters faced this last year, I want to talk about not just one fire at a time, but to give you a feel for why we were stretched so thin. This chart depicts the fires that were started by humans and lightning each day from April 15th to September 16th. And I know it's so busy and blurred, but that time span that's depicted there started in the spring, which is the beginning of our fire season, and ran through the middle of September, which unfortunately was not the end of our fire season. We continued to see fires all the way into October. But the peak of the season, with the dates embedded there, will show you the heart of our summer. There were already fires ongoing, but on July 14th, we had 47 new fires. On July 21st, 35 new fires. On July 27th, 37 new fires. So as you can see, we just were fighting a landscape that was practically entirely on fire. And for each new fire, we had to stretch the same available resources to cover not only continuing to suppress the fires we were already engaged in, but also initial attack on the new starts. On one of the busiest days of the summer there in mid-July, we had just one engine that responded to 10 fires in one day, just running from fire to fire, trying to suppress it, keep it small. Again, on July 16th, just one snapshot in time, we had 86 total fires that we were fighting across the Washington State landscape on that one day. Each dot represents an active fire on that day, and the red ones, red dots, are new lightning starts on that day. DNR sent at least a fire engine or two to every one of these fires. And as the total number of fires burning simultaneously continued to escalate, critical decisions had to be made about leaving resources on a fire or sending them off to catch the next one. And as you well know, we weren't the only state that had fire issues. This depicts the same date, July 16th, both Washington and Oregon. We share resources with the state of Oregon. We both share interagency and federal resources, state and federal resources dispatched out of Boise and Portland. And at the peak of the season, we combined Washington and Oregon were for 43 days the nation's highest firefighting priority. So we had national resources being sent to the Pacific Northwest to help us out for 43 days in a row. Number of acres burned was staggering this year. The 10-year average, the line across the bottom, shows that for 2004 to 2013, the average acres burned in a fire season was around 40,000 acres. Last year was a really big season as well. 126,000 acres were burned, but this year topped both the average and last year with 194,000 acres burned. This is just DNR's jurisdiction, just land that DNR has a protection responsibility on. The bigger number depicted with a star in the upper right corner, that's the total number of acres burned in the state of Washington on all jurisdictions. So 194,000, almost 200,000 acres for DNR, but over 400,000 acres total for service and DNR protection. I'll go quickly through some slides, just give you an idea of the kinds of resources that we sent, the magnitude of the quantities of resources we sent to respond to these fires. Just our helicopters alone, over 1,000 flight hours, almost 8 million buckets of water delivered, which comprises about almost 2 million gallons of water dumped on fires from helicopters this past season. In addition to our helicopters, we contract for fixed wing resources that you're familiar with, the big red swath of fire retardant. You see those dramatic pictures and news coverage. We contract for those and 128 hours of fixed wing time as well. On just the Carlton Complex of fires alone, and I'll go a little bit more depth into Carlton Complex, but on just the Carlton Complex of fires, four lightning-caused fires that ran together, we had over 3,000 personnel on just that complex of fires alone, and as you'll see, the resources that were deployed to those fires were impressive and contributed to that national demand that was being sent to Washington and Oregon. At one point in July, there were 6,800 total personnel fighting fires in the state of Washington, because we had, not only the Carlton Complex going on, but all those other fires that were active at the same time. And we had about one-third of all qualified firefighters in the entire United States actively involved in Washington State's fire essential. This was not cheap. This is a very expensive fire year for us. We're going back to the legislature to supplement our base fire suppression budget. To cover the costs of this summer's fires, we are going to need about $70 million more, total of $93 million fire suppression cost in fiscal year 15. The large fires are very expensive. You'll see that the 904 fires, the red pie, piece of pie in the pie chart, these are the ones that we were able to keep fairly small and were able to use maybe one or two engines, a couple of helicopters. We were able to keep those small. They are relatively inexpensive, but the big ones really run up the cost, especially when we're bringing in National Guard troops, out-of-state and forces. The big retardant aircraft, they really run up the bill on the road. But they're absolutely necessary to eventually suppress those fires. John will just flip through these cost slides, unless board members have a question on cost, and go to the snack room. This pie chart gives you an idea of how those big costs break out. It's largely personnel costs to pay folks involved in the firefight. The equipment itself is also very expensive. And by the way, we do use private contractors. We not only employ local fire districts, but local contractors. And many contractors help us tremendously with bringing dozers, tenders, crews, and helping us out. And we do have to pay their bills as well when they come to help us. The camp support is important. Camp is not luxurious. These are very primitive camps. Folks pitch a tent, throw down a sleeping bag, they fall exhausted into the tent at the end of the shift, and we try to feed them well. I give you an idea of what it takes to feed firefighters. Their caloric intake that we provide to them is 6,000 calories a day, which it certainly put me on the treadmill, but it's basic for them. I just keep them going. Just some photos to give you an idea of the ferocious nature of these fires. This was the Snag Canyon fire just north of Owensburg. It's unbelievable. The kinds of fire environments that our folks were in this summer, even our most experienced firefighters were talking about how they've just never seen this kind of fire behavior before. Those extremely dry conditions, those strong winds, and fire just moving so rapidly across the landscape. Mills Canyon, up in Chelan County, actually preceded the ones that have gained the most notoriety. Mills Canyon quickly grew into a complex. It burned over 22,000 acres and cost almost or a little over $9 million to suppress. Another complex, Chelan County was hit so hard this year. Another complex up in Chelan County was the Chihuahuan complex. You just look at that, at the conditions, and realize how dangerous that was. That's right along the river there, and you can, the slide's a little bit dim, but you can see a couple of fire engines over on the left side on the canyon road. Burned over 14,000 acres and cost almost $30 million to suppress. But the one that has really impressed so many people because it was so devastating to the communities of Central Washington was the Carlton Complex of fires up in Okanagan County. And this is what it looked like in Brewster, Washington, as that fire approached Brewster. It's just frightening to look at and unimaginable to actually look in there. We have a fire progression map that I hope will activate, John. So this is the Carlton Complex of Fires. The first lightning burst came on July 15th. There were four lightning bursts. And John, if you could pause there for just a moment. Four lightning bursts grew together over a very short period of time, over only 4 days of time. And at the end of that fourth day, they had already covered this 127,000 acres. The dark green, so John, is it possible for you to go back to the 17th and activate that again? The dark green is the movement of that fire in one day. covered 30 miles in one day, and there really was no stopping it. That was the day that unfortunately took so many homes in Pateros, Alta Lake, and wound up burning the Pred. Eventually, over 300 homes were lost in this complex of fires. Go ahead and finish running. Tremendously damaging fire. Unbelievable, the devastation to the communities. It's really difficult to express in mere words how frightening that was and how damaging it was for local communities. And frankly, for our professional firefighters as well. It was a terrifying situation. And here are some of the impacts to forested lands as a result of just the Carlton complex. As mentioned, as far as the acres burned, over a quarter million acres. Of those, 99,000 acres were private. And the impacts of fires that burned so intensely and so quickly left soil that there's no mineral soil left. It's just scorched earth in the path of this fire in several areas. The dozer line and hand line, the 116 miles of line that was dug, will be paid for out of the fire suppression costs. We will restore, reseed, and correct any damage that was done in cutting line. The rest of those impacts on the landscape will be addressed through landowner responsibility, and DNR will do our best to help the landowners address that. But these pictures show the kind of damage that each landowner is facing. If you were in the path of the Carlton Complex fires, you were left with a scorched, absolutely scorched landscape. The miles of fence that were lost amounted to, it just says hundreds of miles of range and boundary fencing were burned, and 37,000 acres with high soil erosion hazard, over 8,000 acres of water repellent soil. And the photograph on your right is a typical situation in which the soils will have to be replenished, and they were highly erodible. Unfortunately, the fire storms were followed by rainstorms, and there was a great deal of erosion at the topsoil. So what DNR has available to assist landowners after they've experienced devastating fires like this is primarily information. We can go out, help each landowner. We've attended numerous resource fairs and have participated with landowners already and are continuing to do so to help them just conduct a site visit, help them evaluate the situation on their land after the fires. Many people who have not experienced this situation, that's most landowners, have never experienced anything like this, simply don't know where to start. So we help them to just evaluate the damage that was done and begin a restoration plan. Just help them determine what condition their soils are in, what kind of soil amendments they might employ on their land, what kind of restoration, forest restoration strategy they can begin, where can they find resources to help with the restoration. Typical kind of a handout is the After the Burn publication that comes out from the University of Idaho Extension Service. Well, of course, we also work with our local conservation districts and the numerous other more locally designed information pieces that we can provide to them. We've also looked for any cost share financial assistance that we can give to landowners, and in coordination with other entities, particularly conservation districts, try to help landowners with the tremendous expense of recovering from these fires. Moreover, part of what the Resource Protection Division wants to take out of this horrible situation is the opportunity to educate landowners about how to prevent this kind of devastation. Once they have a restored forest in the future, How can they create defensible space around their homes? How can they treat the forested landscape to try to minimize this kind of damage going in the future? Because we, unfortunately, do not expect this to be a rare occasion after climate change and forest health conditions going forward. We have projections from scientific studies indicating that this is the new normal for the wildland-fire environment, especially in eastern Washington. Board Member Spivey?
Yeah, thank you, Mary. Just a quick question based on that last point. Do you think with the intensity of fires and the, you know, the speed and heat with which they went through some of these places, that sort of thinning and defensible space around homes would have helped? You know, or were there some places where, sort of regardless of what someone did, they likely would have lost their home anyway?
Both. The answer is yes to both. We will show you just a couple of slides, an example of an area in which a landowner did take advantage of defensible space. In fact, John, could you go ahead and flip forward a couple of slides? Let's see, that couple. That one. One of the properties that was right in the middle of the Carlton Complex area in Okanagan County was successful. The landowner immediately contacted us, and as the reports were still coming in about the devastation to surrounding properties in the area, this landowner contacted us and said, "Hey, I think it worked. We came in, we reduced the fuel load, we thinned, we helped them create defensible space around their homes." She indicated that while there were other fires, that she could see fires in the crowns and properties near hers, it was just creeping along in the underbrush, the thinned underbrush around their property. However, there's never going to be a guarantee that treatment will prevent a fire from burning the forest or the home when it's coming through so quickly and such heat and intensity. It's going to depend on where they are in the terrain, where that home is located, because when it's just moving that fast and such a ferocious fire, even some areas that have had treatment were burned through. So it's not a guarantee, but it's certainly a good practice. DNR's landowner assistance mission, like its firefighting mission, is comprehensive, covers the entire state. There are functions in both the forestry programs in the state and the fire programs in the state to help landowners to not only look at defensible space for fire purposes, but also to have healthier forest on the land. So the Small Forest Landowner Office, which is within the Forest Practices Division, helps landowners to manage their lands, to come up with management strategies and work with our Forest Health Program to try to minimize the impact of forest insects and diseases, and therefore keep the land in healthy forest, not only for industrial landowners, but also for small forest landowners. It's basically the same practices that we try to employ on state land. We share those with private landowners. We've already talked about Ann Stanton's property. So an idea of, at a landscape level, how much treatment is needed in just eastern Washington. And to orient you, the embedded map is only eastern Washington. The line that runs through slightly upper to middle of the map is Highway I-90 running through Moses Lake. There's the basin area, and you'll see the town of Wenatchee at the base of the hills there. Every red hue on that map is an area that is in high need of treatment. These stands are too dense. They're typically at an elevated risk for severe insect and disease and wildfire damage. They're where over 45% of the forest needs thinning or some sort of a reduction in density in order to protect them from severe forest health conditions and the high probability of wildfire. In total, and go back to that in just a second, in total, almost 3 million acres in eastern Washington need some sort of disturbance or treatment in order to restore them to a healthy natural condition. Some of this, just to state the obvious, but it bears repeating, is that forest health treatments are important for a number of reasons. And this summer taught us, again, why public safety is such an important reason that we pursue forest health treatments across the state of Washington, but also, of course, for natural resource protection and then the environmental services that are provided by healthy forest. Here you have a before and after. The previous testimonial that we had from Ms. Stanton, whose property was in the Carlton Complex, is one example of how the stand looks before and after treatment. But this is a more typical eastern Washington landscape without a home in it. We help landowners go out and address the kind of landscape that you're looking at on the left-hand side with some pretty simple management techniques on the ground. Just thin, take out the diseased and trees of very poor health, open it up, open space up so that healthy trees can grow, and get rid of those fuel ladders that contribute to such high fire danger. This is the strategic need that the Department of Natural Resources has identified for us to be able to address the kind of year that we just experienced. We have to look synergistically at forest health and fire risk reduction comprehensively as really the hand in the glove. We have to address forest health because it's a high fire danger. We have to address high fire danger in order to have a healthy forest. So we're looking strategically at these are intertwined responsibilities and missions of the department. In order to be successful in reducing the fuel load on the ground, however, as you all know, there needs to be a market. There's not a market for that material. And it's very expensive to remove it, especially from sites in rural eastern Washington, where the transportation cost can far exceed the value of the biomass itself. So we're also working to find end users to use that biomass, either for cogeneration, for fuel, for heating, or the more innovative technologies such as a liquid biofuel. There's also an opportunity for this material to be used in construction, but as you know, that's more of the board-foot wood and not the chip wood. And then just increased preparedness. The agency has not fully recovered in its resources since the 2008 recession. Every government, as with the private sector, suffered a lot of cutbacks during the recession. And we've never fully restored the staffing that we have in our fire response capability for DNR. So we put in what we consider to be a fairly modest request to the legislature this year to help us restore at least 10 of our engine crews, 7 more members of our HeliTAC crews, and some of the folks to help with management of our fires, and then some safety for our helicopter crews. We have 7 Huey helicopters that we are on a $1 a year lease from the federal government, so we're very frugal, but we do need to improve our ability to operate those helicopters safely so they can be out there to suppress the fires in the first few minutes after the bell rings. So we've covered a lot in a short period of time. I've talked fast because Aaron told me I needed to, in order to give the board plenty of time to ask questions and move on to the next agenda item. But I'd like to open the floor for questions at this point.
Questions for board members?
I have a question.
Board member Murray.
So I was looking at a graph recently, and I think in 2012, the cost for fire suppression for the U.S. Forest Service, just for the Okanagan Wenatchee National Forest, was about $80 million. And then you put up figures that are comparable for 2014. And it seems to me that, creating markets, there's a benefit to creating markets because those costs are astronomical. And from what you're indicating, it looks like that pattern won't necessarily be going away. And so are you thinking of expanding how your agency approaches alternative uses and your role in that?
Thank you for that question and your astute commentary about our dilemma. If we don't invest, then we're going to pay for it one way or another. We're going to pay in suppression costs or we're going to pay in hazard reduction costs. Yes, the department is looking at innovative ways and sometimes rather costly ways to explore other uses for that wood biomass on the landscape. And what I mean by rather costly is that we've been willing to experiment with paying more per acre to remove the material from really dense stands. I'm talking about super dense stands. The photos are impressive. There are some stands you can't even walk through. The stands are so thick. But we paid more per acre to test the market, to see if we can make that feasible. To deliver that material, I'm thinking in particular of a plot up near the Kettle Falls Avista biofuel facility. And we've paid more to take the material off of that acreage and deliver it to Kettle Falls just to test whether or not that's a viable operation. Getting things to scale is a challenge, but we do feel that it's worthwhile to continue to explore and try to drive that market. We're working with Central Washington University, as you're probably aware, on delivering some biomass to their generator against the cost to deliver it. One might argue it's offset by the reduced cost of having a hazard out on the landscape where we know if a wildfire gets it, it's going to burn one way or another. It's either going to burn the biomass generator or it's going to burn on the landscape.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mary and John?
I'm just wondering if anyone's keeping track of the jobs created and obtained by the opportunity for restoration. So looking at all the restoration efforts that you've done and those that you have in front of you, I'm just thinking about the need to for funding for this and making a connection to the jobs, especially in rural areas and long term.
That's an excellent point. I would actually need to talk with the folks in the forestry programs to see how that's being tracked.
There are a couple of recent studies in Oregon about the economic multiplier, basically, of a given $1 million of public investment in forest restoration activities, and that's about $6 for every $1 that you invest. So it's a 6-to-1 return as far as the overall net economic benefit. And I think the same study had some employment figures associated with it, direct employment figures associated for it. I can't follow up right off the top of my head. But I did want to mention that the department, at the request of the legislature, completed a restoration needs analysis. You saw a map product that's part of a Nature Conservancy Forest Service study that looked at estimated restoration needs across eastern Washington. That was something that we were able to incorporate in that report to the legislature. It also details some of the economic considerations, the cost-benefit considerations from an investment standpoint, as well as a little bit on employment, and also the accomplishments that the department's achieved with not only federal grant dollars, of which they're a fairly considerable amount, but state capital money that the legislature's appropriated over the last several fiscal years. So what I do, if you're interested, is to distribute that report to board members, and it really is a pretty excellent product. Many of our staff work really hard on it. It does help get grasp on the problem and what we've been doing about it.
And this may be beyond what you're prepared to talk about today, but have we done a risk assessment for Western Washington in terms of stands and at risk? Historically, large fires were part of the ecology here in Western Washington. Also, I kind of live out in the woods, and every August, I suppose, they're really nervous.
Yeah.
But could we look at that?
A formal risk assessment for fire risk, I'm not aware of one. We have, of course, the history of large fires all across the state. But as we go through the fire season, there's a constant analysis of risk. And as you saw the state fire map, we may maintain minimum staffing on the western side of the state at all times, which is one reason, even though eastern Washington, you know, is on fire, basically, we can't abandon western Washington, so we always maintain resources to fight fires on this side of the state, because we're constantly monitoring those remote automated radar stations and looking at the weather that's coming in on the west side of the state and in similarly dry conditions with similar opportunities for lightning bursts, especially in southwestern Washington, but really anywhere in western Washington. And we did have fires and had to maintain that minimum level of resources so that we could respond to them. So that's going on an ongoing basis throughout the fire season, looking statewide at where's the risk on any given, you know, week and day and portion of the day, so that we're positioning our resources on this case-by-case basis. The forest health condition assessment is more thorough on the east side of the state. As a result of the past studies in designating the forest health hazard warning areas, but it's never a bad time to look at statewide what is the condition of our forest, and the forest health program is constantly assessing that. We fly the, you're probably familiar with flying the bugs and crud layer. That's a statewide assessment that's done every year just to look at those trends in forest health and fire risk. If you have suggestions for us, we'd be glad to take your from you.
Member Lori?
Have you looked at, or do you just offhand have any sense of whether forest practices rules contribute to reduction of the risks in forest, through forest health or anything else, either inhibit that or maybe contribute to our being able to address those issues?
Mm-hmm. Because that is going to be, in many cases, site-specific, I need to answer to, you know, paint with a broad brush. It's certainly something that we see, that when land is actively managed and well managed, it's a much better environment in terms of a reduced risk of wildfire and easier to fight the fire on the land if one occurs there. You have anchor points where firefighters can actually get in and cut a line and fight the fire from there. As opposed to, you know, stands that are in poor condition, often the best you can do is fight the fire from the perimeter. You really just, you know, can't get in the middle of the site to accurately fight the fire. I bet the state forester has a better insight into that.
The staff to the board and stakeholders went through a competition a couple of years ago, that you might recall, about template. It was an alternate plan template around the issue of mortality in riparian management zones in eastern Washington. We did end up with a template product out of that discussion. It didn't seem that the group had come to agreement around that. But I think there was some technical guidance that got issued around a site-by-site alternate plan process where we had a riparian management zone that was experiencing a lot of concentrated mortality, and what you might do about that to, you know, maintain shade to function as much as you could. Beyond that, it's, you know, really as far as how much thinning folks want to do, or
it's up to them.
It is up to them.
We're not in the way.
I'm sure there would be some landowners out in the world who might dispute that. My sense is that both in terms of the timeliness of the permit processing and flexibility where needed around meeting our resource protection objectives at the same time we're meeting landowners' forest health protection objectives, not seeing that come into conflict. Other questions for Mary? Mary and John, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We are on to our last item of business for the day. Next to last. Before I do that, and before I forget, Mark, in our work planning discussion, noted for us, and we promptly did follow through, that we need to vote on next year's meeting dates. And Mark proposed those to be, Patricia's out of the room and not keeping track of what I'm talking about. Mark proposed those to be the second Tuesday
And the dates, Mark, were?
I know the first one's February 10th.
Look at the bottom of your agenda.
Everybody heard.
Yeah, February.
Yes.
Oh, there we go. Second Tuesday of February. So usually, because this is, as Mark mentioned, a bit of a departure from the statutorily prescribed meeting, they take formal board action on it simply to acknowledge that we're doing this to accommodate members of the board and their participation. So as a piece of normal business, I'd like a motion to this effect if someone is willing.
I move
Forest Practices Board change the 2015 meeting dates to the second Tuesday of February, May, August, and November.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Board Member Morgan. We'll, for our faithful staff, keep track of this.
We did.
Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mark, for reminding me of that. Now we're on to our last item of business of the day, which is an update on Northern Spotted Owl implementation team. So I've asked Lauren to join us today. You have a memo in your day of board packet from Lauren, which is informative as always. Lauren, why don't you take it away?
Great, thank you, Chair Everett. Good afternoon, members of the Forest Practices Board. For the record, Lauren Burns, Northern Spotted Owl implementation team coordinator. Just to quickly go over what's in the memo, happy to announce that our multi-year analysis from our technical team is completed and it will soon be in your inboxes. So I'm sure you're very much looking forward to reading the entire technical analysis as well as both appendices. So the implementation team plans on returning at the next board meeting to have a much more robust discussion, so I won't give any spoilers to what's inside. You'll have to read it. But ultimately, it's an issue of additional habitat can make a difference so long as you control the barn owl. So members met in October to discuss some pending items related to the technical team analysis. They approved of it being transmitted to the board, as well as an optional phase four analysis that we currently don't have funding for. So members of the implementation team decided they're going to turn over couch cushions and see if they can find some money to help fund the analysis. So we'll find out more when the implementation team meets in December. So there's that. In addition, last time I spoke, we had an open period for the riparian and habitat open space program. We've received 20 applications, and we're currently working with the implementation team to develop basically a metric for ranking these applications. I know that Forest Practices Division staff are currently working with landowner applications that meet those criteria to do some basically ground truthing and site visits. So I believe the expectation is by December to come back to the implementation team to share how those applications ranked per the implementation team's requests. Anything from, you know, the side of the status of the circle, if there is spotted owl habitat in that application, whether it occurs in or outside of the SOC, whether it's part of some larger habitat framework that's adjacent to federal lands or other sorts of conservation landscapes. So we'll hopefully have some more information in the next couple months. And lastly, happy to announce that Fish and Wildlife Service has recently reached out to us and provided a point of contact for us to work with them for our Safe Harbor Agreement, our programmatic, voluntary, optional Safe Harbor Agreement for landowners. We had kind of a high-level discussion in October just to kind of pick members' brains of what we want this to look like. There's a lot of different structures out there for programmatic Safe Harbor Agreements, mostly used in Southeast United States related to the red-pocketed woodpecker. But there's also the Oregon Department of Forestry Northern Spotted Owl Programmatic Agreement that focuses more on small forest landowners. So between now and our next meeting in December, we'll be working to provide one of many iterations of a draft for implementation team members to kind of use that to go work with Fish and Wildlife Service So I guess with that, if members have any questions, I'm happy to answer now.
So I'll preface a bit. Lauren's here to flag for you all an excellent and thorough and rigorous, as was noted in the earlier public comment period, report of the technical team. And I don't think we ought to let that pass as a board without spending some more time on it. We spent a little bit of time on it, I think, at the November meeting of 2013. And so you can anticipate that in February we will spend some more time on it. What the results of that report are. It does bear on the board's work moving forward. We also, at the November 2013 meeting, approved a set of recommendations from the implementation team around this safe harbor concept and a few other action items. And so we're going to need to discuss in February how much interaction the board would like to have with the technical team as we're considering options, how closely involved the board would like to be in that decision making. And I'm comfortable with a few different options in that respect, but it's going to require us to be creative, to continue to work as we have with our stakeholders. And this is a stay tuned for coming attractions type of discussion that I want to flag for the board members as we come through the holiday season. But other board members have questions for Lauren? Board member Sneed.
I just wanted to endorse the riveting and cutting edge nature of the technical team report. And I'm actually not kidding. It's really well done. Carl Whitaker was staff science participated on it. You know, Lauren helped shepherd it through. Aaron made sure it got done. We asked them lots of good hard questions and they delivered. So I would encourage you to, you know, relax over a beer or a glass of wine and give it a good read before the next board meeting.
Other questions for Lauren? Here, do you have a question for Lauren? Okay, come back. Other questions or discussions on this subject? Again, it's a little bit of a placeholder, so.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lauren. Mark, you have a last order of business before we adjourn.
No, I just would like to add that in the review of the proposed conservation easements for critical habitats that we're undertaking. We do have $500,000 appropriated by the legislature. Those conservation easements will be purchased by the last day of June of 2015. That's when the end result of this will be conservation
easements. And pertinent to the budget discussion request, or this budget request discussion of earlier today, the department incorporated a number of the applications that we've got in this solicitation, this year's solicitation for RIPS Habitat and Open Space program into the 2015-17 budget request, although those may not end up being the final projects. It does help an awful lot for the appropriators to understand a little more specifics about the individual projects that are out there, potentially out there. If there are no further items of business for the day, after our long day here, I appreciate your time and attention and energy to the important business we have. I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make that motion.
Board Member Little makes the motion, and we have all second. No discussion on the motion is going to be permitted. I think we don't, just without objection, adjourn. Thank you all very much.